How's he doing up there?
We're getting better than 40%.
What about the second position?
It's not so good.
Who's interested in these two anyway?
I don't know for sure.
The Justice Department?
No.
And I figure it must be the Infernal Revenue. The tapes always put me to sleep.
Since when are you here to be entertained? Here.
Sometimes it's nice to know what they're talking about.
I don't care what they're talking about. All I want is a nice, fat recording.
I'm Nick Nylund, and this is Keynotes. Each episode, we examine the innovative ways music is used in film. Today's topic is a personal choice, my all-time favorite movie, Francis Ford Coppola's paranoid thriller from 1974, The Conversation. The reason I'm so taken by The Conversation is that it's expertly crafted. Every detail informs the whole. It's a story about surveillance, paranoia, the invasion of privacy, and the breakdown of perception. Coppola shoots through frosted glass and off of mirrors. He often leaves the frame empty before characters walk into view, as if to imply a fixed, surveillance-style camera. Even the intensely private main character's name, Harry Caul, C-A-U-L, refers to a fetal membrane that can cover a newborn's head. Throughout the film, he wears a partially transparent raincoat. It's a detective-style trench, which firstly associates him with the hard-boiled cynic of film noir. But its transparency again reminds us of seeing through and into things. It exposes him. As this is a story about audio surveillance, this attention to craftsmanship of course extends to the soundtrack, to sound designer Walter Murch's groundbreaking work, and to composer David Shire's haunting piano score. We'll get to Shire and Murch's contributions in a little while, but there are two associated films we're going to talk about in addition to The Conversation. Each of the film's thematic ideas are essential to understanding the role of music, so we'll be discussing the themes in quite a bit of detail. I'll also include a spoiler warning on the plots of The Conversation, Blow Up, and the third film, Blowout. Finally, before we start, I'd like to cite as research material Juan Chadha's film score guide for The Conversation as a guidepost for much of the music theory-based analysis. Chadha's research also involved interviews with David Shire himself, and so is an invaluable resource.
I thought you were supposed to be in Paris.
I am in Paris.
When Francis Ford Coppola sat down to write The Conversation, one of the films he had in mind was a British-Italian film made a few years prior. In 1966, Italian filmmaker Michelangelo Antonioni made a film called Blow Up. It was set in swinging London, and his main character was an unnamed fashion photographer. Played by David Hemmings, he's introduced leaving a doss house, a homeless shelter, having spent time there taking art photos. We see him in disguise, wearing phony rags. Then he hops into a Rolls Royce and drives to his studio, an early clue-in on one of the film's main interests, tricks of perception. This world is painted as shallow, vacuous. Antonioni commissioned Herbie Hancock to write hip jazz music for the film's soundtrack. Beautifully composed as they may be, Hancock's tracks play as lounge and party music, perhaps not underscoring the emotion of the film, but playing in counterpoint to it. As the story gets existential, this kind of music seems increasingly empty. Nearly all of the tracks appear in the film as source cues, songs the characters themselves have switched on. The photographer puts this track on as he's flirting with Vanessa Redgrave's character, Jane. As such, it's as if the characters in the world are curating the music, rather than the film itself. Other films have used these sort of needle-drop soundtracks to give us a portrait of a specific subculture. Just as Blow Up uses Hancock's jazz to immerse us in the stylish world of 60s high fashion in London, the disco music of Saturday Night Fever is both essential to the story and the disco scene in late 70s Brooklyn. Composer of The Conversation, David Shire, wrote some original music for Saturday Night Fever, including this cue. Unlike John Travolta's disco dancer Tony Manero, who's exhilarated by the music, the photographer in Blow Up has become bored with his world. As the story goes on, he finds himself at an increasing distance from it. He can't reconcile how he feels about the world with the way others are living. At one point, he ends up in a rock venue. The Yardbirds, especially hip at the time, are playing a show to a bunch of zombie-faced spectators. The dirty, high-energy blues rock is another clever musical juxtaposition. It's at odds with the coolly distant audience. It's this contrasting relationship between music and image that creates meaning. The guitarist, Jeff Beck, begins having technical problems, and in frustration smashes his amp and guitar. The broken guitar neck flings into the crowd and is retrieved by the photographer. The audience now becomes a mob and chases after him and the musical object. He eludes them outside only to realize he doesn't care about the guitar neck. He drops it on the sidewalk and heads away. Another pedestrian picks it up, but then does the same. One thing that Antonioni is getting at in Blow Up is the elusiveness of perception. For the raging fans, the guitar neck represents a piece of history. It has aura. It belongs to a musical artist, Jeff Beck. Out of that context, it's a broken piece of junk. Like Harry Call in The Conversation, the photographer in Blow Up becomes sort of an amateur detective, and his investigation reveals just how tricky perception can be. The photographer stealthily photographs a couple in the park from a large distance. Later at lunch, he notices he's being followed by a mysterious man. When he develops his images and enlarges them, he thinks he sees a person in the trees aiming a pistol at the lovers. Subsequent photographs perhaps reveal the male lover's body. It's hard to tell, as each time the image is enlarged, the grainier the image becomes. The closer you look, the less you know. A key principle in Blow Up and The Conversation. In the titular scene where the images are blown up and examined, Antonioni withholds music, instead giving us the ambient sounds of the park in which he snapped the photos. Since we're inside his studio, the sounds might be imagined by the main character as he's turning his pictures into a living reality. We're meant to consider that movies are doing the same thing. The montage theory of editing tells us that placing two shots side by side creates new meaning. In one shot, a man stares blankly. In the next, a bowl of soup. The meaning that's created is that the man's hungry. Here, an image interpreted to contain a man with a pistol followed by an image interpreted to contain a dead body, creates a third meaning, murder. But perhaps all of these images are treacherous. Perhaps, like the sounds of the park that can't exist in this space, it's merely a construction. As the film goes on, the logic of the world seems to unravel. The murder mystery, or whether or not there even was a murder, is never resolved, because it doesn't matter. The film ends famously on a scene of the photographer watching mimes playing tennis. The empty camera frame pans where the ball would be. When they pantomime the ball being knocked over the fence, the main character pretends to pick it up and throws it back to them in the court. Then we begin to hear the sound effect of a tennis ball bouncing back and forth off the rackets. In this moment, the photographer has bought into their constructed reality. The act of tossing the imaginary ball might coincide with our suspension of disbelief each time we sit down to watch a film. He, like us, is agreeing to participate in the artificial reality, buying in, even though it's a fantasy. The final image is the photographer dissolving away within the green grass of the field. One last reminder that this has all been a construction. The hip and jazzy Herbie Hancock music kicks back in, perhaps feeling even more at emotional odds, given the existential roller coaster we've ridden. Compare this to a jazz-based score like Lalo Schifrin's Bullet. Here, the score is not meant to create juxtaposition, but to reinforce, to magnify the title character's persona. The music brings us on board. Something like The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, the music again sells us the characters. But in this case, it's to lend the villains, the ones we'd normally be opposed to, an air of cool. In part, we almost like them. Music by The Conversation's David Shire, by the way. Lalo Schifrin of Bullet wrote quite a number of thrilling groovy scores for action characters, like this one for Clint Eastwood's Dirty Harry. But the Harry in The Conversation is a very different kind of hero, a more complicated, inward-looking figure. He's in way over his head, unlike Frank Bullet or Dirty Harry, or even the gritty cop Popeye Doyle that Gene Hackman played in The French Connection prior to The Conversation. Harry Call would require a more complex and sensitive musical approach.
Tired of drinking anyhow.
What a stupid conversation.
Stan, please, I'm trying to work.
What the hell are they talking about, for Christ's sake?
Stanley, please, I'm trying to get this done.
Why? Don't get excited.
Well, I'm getting fed up.
Well, I can't see why a couple of questions about what the hell's going on can get you so out of joint.
Because I can't sit here and explain the personal problems of my clients.
Room 773.
You heard, if you filled me in a little bit once in a while, did you ever think of that?
It has nothing to do with me, and even less to do with you.
It's curiosity. Did you ever hear of that? It's just goddamn human nature.
Listen, if there's one surefire rule that I have learned in this business is that I don't know anything about human nature. I don't know anything about curiosity. That's not part of what I do. This is my business.
Kill us if he got the chance. Kill us if he got the chance.
Coppola's story maintains a stricter logic than Antonioni's, though the main character struggles with similar challenges of perception. At the start of the conversation, Harry Call is an audio surveillance expert who tries to keep an arm's distance from his subjects. He doesn't ask questions. He claims not to care. We'll learn eventually he's racked with guilt from a previous job that presumably ended with his subjects getting killed. Coppola foregrounds his characteristic guilt by making him a Catholic. His job has made him intensely private and paranoid. He knows the limits of privacy and therefore lives his life on guard. He's afraid of opening up, as that would make him vulnerable. He sees his relationships, friends and lovers slip away because of the distance he keeps. It's these traits that inform David Shire's musical treatment of Harry, and by extension, the film as a whole. Loneliness, distance, paranoia, guilt. The final concept comes from the story, the issues of perception borrowed from Blow Up. We've talked before about film noir and how the jazzy solo horn became a trope to represent the hard-boiled detective. The solo instrument suggests loneliness, and jazz itself suggests danger, edginess, a touch of sex. David Shire himself wrote this theme for the neo-noir Farewell My Lovely, starring Robert Mitchum, a classic noir leading man, playing the aging PI Philip Marlowe. Saxophone would have been an easy instrumental choice for Harry Call's theme. After all, Harry plays the jazz saxophone as a hobby. Here we have one of the source tracks, a peppy jazz cue Shire wrote for the conversation. It's one of the songs Harry uses to practice improvising on saxophone. Jazz, a highly improvisational genre, suggests freedom and release. More importantly, jazz ensembles are by their nature social, a very public genre reduced here to a lonely, private space. In jazz, the music develops from players reacting to one another, in conversation with one another. Harry's attempts to improvise are sloppy. He makes mistakes, a symbol of his awkward social skills. Shire and Coppola retained the genre of jazz, but felt the piano was lonelier and probably less on the nose. Shire himself plays the instrument. The theme for Harry Call is in melancholic A minor. It's divided into a few sections. The first one Shire calls the reflection motif, a musical introduction meant to represent Harry's looking inward, the character being trapped in his own privacy. The middle part is the result of the privacy, the solitude section. The piano part is spiraling, circling, like the tapes on Harry's reel-to-reel, but more importantly, the lonely loop in which he's caught. Then there's another motif, Chada calls the sinful leitmotif, an especially bluesy figure suggesting guilt, maybe both his past mistakes and also his fear of repeating them. The theme's primary form is in 3-4 rather than 4-4. The slightly shorter bars help sell the idea of insistent cycling. Chada theorizes that the theme can be split between the two hands, each representing opposing sides of Harry. The left hand playing the bass part and maintaining the pulse is his methodical, controlling, and repressive side, while the right hand running the jazzy figures is more spontaneous, craving freedom and interaction, which is, of course, also tied to the character's passion for playing jazz on his own. Shire is also intentionally flexible with tempo, speeding up and slowing down. Each time the theme moves faster, we might see this as Harry's attempts to break free, but the controlling left hand elastically pulls him back, slows him down, traps him. The conversation begins with Harry on an assignment. He's tasked with recording two lovers talking in a public space, San Francisco's Union Square, a setting meant to make us think of Dealey Plaza and JFK. The obsessive replaying of the recorded conversation might be compared to our national obsession with the replaying of the Zapruder film. Harry grows suspicious of his employer's intentions, and as such refuses to turn in the recording. The company begins to watch and pursue him, eavesdropping on the eavesdropper himself. This assignment has its own motif that goes like this. It's mysterious, uncertain, ungrounded. It lacks a clear, pulsing time signature. As Harry's private life gets twisted up with the conspiracy, the assignment theme, and his personal theme merge. Here, when Harry calls the director's office from a phone booth, the assignment theme is given the same metrical treatment as Harry's theme, and is mixing harmonically with its middle section. In other words, this. And this. Mixed together to give us this. The themes continue to twist and shift as the plot thickens. As Harry sits in confession with a priest, guiltily talking about his past and present fears, Shire darkly renders the reflection intro to Harry's theme in 9-4, an asymmetrical meter, to suggest his lack of psychological balance. Shire isn't alone in finding ways to sour the music as the film goes on. Editor and sound designer Walter Murch cleverly processed Shire's recordings through an ARP synthesizer to distort them. Like looking through a sheet of fogged glass, the processed audio suggests an obscured perspective, a filtered version of the original sound. Harry may be filtering one kind of distortion when he takes this garbled piece of tape. And routes it through his custom equipment to reveal the dialogue.
He'd kill us if he got the chance.
but he's failed to consider his own filter, his subjective interpretation. This line, "he'd kill us if he got the chance," convinces Harry that the director intends to kill the lovers, and he's afraid of making the same mistake he's made in the past. A sub-thread of Harry's story relates to his failures of intimacy. He can't maintain a steady relationship because he refuses to open up. We first see this when he visits the girl Amy Fredericks. It's revealed through their conversation that he pays her rent and drops in to visit her unannounced. But now she tells him he's too inaccessible and breaks up with him. Amy herself has a leitmotif, but we can think of it as more of a lament for Harry, representing the possibility, but failure, of romance. This is her melody. A phrase usually associated with this that often precedes it is related to Harry's distrust of women. It's slightly sleazy and bluesy, and it will roll right into Amy's motif. Therefore, we can think of Harry's feelings about relationships as kind of a paradox, wary of being betrayed, but also longing for companionship. The former holds him back from the latter. Later in the film, after a surveillance convention, Harry's colleagues are partying at his workspace. With them is a woman named Meredith that Harry is interested in. In a wonderful weaving together of thematic material, Shire expertly moves between three themes, the reflection part of Harry's theme as he's wondering about himself. Amy's motif as he's asking for advice about her. And the female distrust motif as Meredith speaks. We begin with the bass line from Amy's theme.
Could you, if you were a girl and waited for someone?
Then Harry's reflection motif.
You can trust me.
Female distrust motif.
Really knew.
Amy's motif as he's talking about her.
When he was going to come to see her, you just lived in a room alone and you knew nothing about him. And if you loved him, you were patient with him. And even though he didn't dare ever tell you anything about himself personally, even though he may have loved you, would you?
Harry's reflection motif.
Would you go back to him?
The female distrust motif.
How would I know? How would I know that he loved me?
You'd have no way of knowing.
Amy's theme. Harry's friends show up and interrupt the reflection motif.
Hey,
We finish the scene on the solitude section as she runs off with them. Leaving Harry lonely in a wide shot. That night, Harry will sleep with Meredith, and in the morning, he'll awaken to find that she's taken the tapes. She's been hired to get close to him by the company, and probably his colleague Moran. The stakes have been raised, so Harry rushes off to the hotel where the couple said they'd meet. He hears screams, sees a bloody hand on the frosted glass, and discovers a toilet filled with blood. All these things point to what he fears most. His recording seems to have gotten the lovers killed. But then at the office, he sees the girl alive.
Sunday, definitely.
Jack Tar Hotel. 3 o'clock, room 773.
We hear the recording again.
Kill us if you got the chance.
He'd kill us if he got the chance. Murch has altered the recording to emphasize the word us, and the line now has a different subtext. He'd kill us, so we need to kill him. Harry had it backwards. The couple killed the director to take over the company. A failure of perception, the same muck the photographer from Blow Up was caught in. Two amateur snoops, knowing less the closer they look. Hello. Harry is now under watch by the company. The man who bugs himself has been bugged. The film's last sequence involves Harry ripping up his apartment, looking for hidden microphones. The final shot sees the camera mounted high up, oscillating back and forth like a security camera. The walls and floors of the apartment have been wrecked. Having failed to find the bug, Harry sits in a corner playing saxophone. Notice that the notes from the saxophone conflict with Shire's score, different keys, out of time with one another. The music finishes on Harry's theme, suggesting that this is the new status quo. That he's permanently trapped in this state of lonely paranoia. Other directors would be influenced by David Shire's score. When David Fincher needed some original music for his thriller Zodiac, he not only turned to the approach from The Conversation, but to David Shire himself, who wrote this theme for the main character, Robert Graysmith, a man also plagued by obsession and paranoia. Zodiac is also, of course, set in San Francisco. And director James Mangold would take inspiration from The Haunting Piano in Logan, his subversion of the superhero genre. Logan, like Harry Call, is a loner haunted by the past. Mangold listened to the conversation soundtrack while writing the script, and composer Marco Beltrami borrowed some spiritual ideas from it.
Do you realize how many conspiracy nuts I've already had in here today?
No, please. Look, it's very clear in all these photographs, the flash and the smoke.
Could be a lot of things that don't mean nothing. Listen, why the fuck does everything have to be a conspiracy, huh?
Look, let me tell you something. I was there. That tire was shot out. I heard it. I recorded it.
So you're an ear witness to an assassination. That's good. It's got a nice ring. I like that.
If one could characterize Blow Up as a challenging, more highbrow film, then Coppola introduced a level of accessibility to some of the ideas Antonioni was exploring, giving audiences a plot they could follow and invest in. In the third panel of this triptych, we have a filmmaker who not only was aware of the pulpy quality of his films, but embraced and relished in them. That's not to say his film craft is amateur. On the contrary, many consider Brian De Palma to be the successor to Alfred Hitchcock. In fact, he was so obsessed with the films of Hitchcock that he enlisted Hitchcock's most famous musical collaborator, Bernard Herrmann, to compose the scores for two of his early thrillers, Sisters and Obsession. Even after Herrmann died, De Palma's longtime follow-up composer, Pino Donaggio, the man who scored Blowout, frequently borrowed ideas and approaches from Herrmann. In Carrie's infamous prom scene, Donaggio pays homage to Psycho's Shower Murder. And in Dressed to Kill, a film even more laden with Hitchcock references, Donaggio again nods to Herrmann's cue as De Palma transposes the gender-bending murder from the shower to the elevator. De Palma was aware of the part he had to play in the trend of erotic horror films that filled the box office in the 1970s. So aware, in fact, that he's sending himself up in the opening to 1981's Blowout, which begins with a screening of a low-budget horror film called Coed Frenzy. The sequence consists of a point-of-view Steadicam shot of a killer stalking mostly undressed college girls. De Palma's film within a film has fun aping a number of different things, including John Carpenter's Halloween, and similar sequences in De Palma's films, especially Dressed to Kill. The music from Coed Frenzy is a disco track, perhaps a knowing acknowledgement of the musical fad. DiNaggio might have also drawn from the scores to Italian mystery horror films of the day, giallos, like Riz Ortolani's score for 1977's The Pajama Girl Case. Or perhaps the progressive rock band Goblin. Bells, a very popular musical texture in giallo, are reminiscent of Goblin's score for Suspiria. And at this time, disco is very prevalent in film scores. We've already talked about Saturday Night Fever, which helped kick off the craze. Disco music would even find its way into James Bond. But this trend also extended to horror movies. A year before Blowout, the slasher film Prom Night was released. And in some ways, despite parodying it, De Palma delights in similar flair and fashion. This music track, admittedly more rock than disco, is used later in the film, not for a movie within the movie, but as actual underscore for the story. The amazing thing about Brian De Palma is that we're able to talk about these films in the same conversation as Michelangelo and Antonioni. So how does the gratuitous slasher film Coed Frenzy circle back to blow up in the conversation? The scene ends with a killer yanking back a shower curtain, of course an homage to Psycho, except the girl's scream is comically unconvincing.
The scream is terrible.
The main character Jack Terry, portrayed by John Travolta, is a film sound designer in Philadelphia, and he's been instructed to record better sound effects for this movie. So in the evening, Jack goes out to record sounds in the park. Here we get a reference to the conversation as he points his shotgun microphone at a couple in the park, and they express concern about being watched.
David, look, there's someone on the bridge.
Oh, let's not worry about that.
He's staring right at us.
Who cares?
I care.
Betsy.
I don't want to stay here anymore. Let's go.
Yeah,
okay. What is he doing?
I don't know.
What is he, a peeping Tom or something?
Oh, who cares? Come on, let's walk down.
And also a reference to Blow Up, as the sound he's specifically here to record is wind blowing through the trees. You'll recall the photographer looking at his blow-ups, imagining the murder plot, and the wind sounds Antonioni dropped in. Here, De Palma shows us that artifice for what it really is, a sound recordist gathering these sounds to lay over an unassociated scene. But while recording, Jack hears a car skidding and a tire blow out. The car careens into the creek and he dives in to rescue the passengers. And with it, we're given the first instance of non-diegetic film score. Notice how big and operatic the cue is. Neither Coppola nor Antonioni have indulged in their drama to this extent. This moment clues us in on how the music is operating, underlining, magnifying the drama, almost melodramatically. The man in the car drowns, but Jack rescues a girl named Sally. Later he'll find out that the man she was with was the governor, George McRyan, and she was paid to be caught with him, but something went terribly wrong. The politician driving with a girl and crashing into the water is a reference to the Chappaquiddick incident, but in reverse. The politician dies and the girl survives. Things aren't adding up for Jack. In a sequence that calls to mind the photographer forming his narrative with the blow-ups, or Harry Call filtering through the noise to discover the couple's conversation, Jack listens to his recordings on a Nagra tape machine and relives the incident. This moving, mysterious cue not only indicates determined detective work, but also its repetitive and driving rhythm as the camera scans the spinning tape reels reinforces that sense of looping, a visual and philosophical motif in the film. As Jack listens to the tape, he confirms what he thought he heard, a second bang. One is the tire blowout, the other that precedes it might be a gunshot? Here we're mirroring Antonioni, the photographer believing he sees a shooter and victim in his pictures. After a second witness to the crash sells his film reel to the press, the individual frames are published in a magazine, again a reference to the Zapruder film from the JFK assassination. Jack is able to fuse his sound recording to a movie strip he's made from the frames in the magazine, and his suspicions are confirmed. The other bang is in fact a gunshot, as he can see a muzzle flash on the film strip that corresponds with the boom. Unlike Antonioni or Coppola, De Palma does not present a scenario where reality slips away as the amateur sleuth looks closer. In Blowout, truth is discovered by making cinema, by joining its two essential parts, moving image and sound. The problem lies not in the nature of reality and perception, but in the national malaise. Blow Up takes place in a world where people are living empty, hedonistic lives. The conversation tapped into an increasing national paranoia, anticipating Watergate and the surveillance state. Blowout, drenched in red, white, and blue and patriotic imagery, came out at a time after the 70s-era scandals, after Watergate in Vietnam. America has turned to despair, cynicism, and callousness. The couple Jack is recording at the beginning establishes this nicely.
David, look, there's someone on the bridge.
Oh, let's not worry about that.
He's staring right at us.
Who cares?
I care.
Betsy.
I don't want to stay here anymore. Let's go.
Yeah, okay.
What is he doing?
I don't know.
What is he, a Peking Tom or something?
Oh, who cares? Come on, let's walk down.
One person concerned with the invasion of privacy, the other not. This is the significance of the symbol of the swirling tape reel. As Jack Terry becomes invested in the world, he realizes it's gone mad, spinning out of control around him. At one point, Jack returns to his studio to discover his tape reels have been erased, and the camera itself revolves around and around. In their apathy, people have become self-absorbed. They believe the world to be too far gone. they've turned to easy escapes like the slasher films Jack works on. This is an additional layer for the sexy music in Blowout. Is there a tension between the escapist music and a film that is in some ways critiquing escapism? Everyone writes off Jack's discovery, including the police. The sentiment is, it's just another conspiracy theory, or even if it's true, who cares? Meanwhile, there's a sinister fixer, John Lithgow's Burke, actively trying to cover up the assassination. He's sometimes given a snare drum along with a trumpet as part of his musical material, which ties him perhaps to the military or the government, or more broadly, to cold and driven plotting. It was Burke who fired the shot. He's formally introduced replacing the governor's tire with one that doesn't have a bullet hole. An apt representation of painting over the truth. He's now set his sights on loose ends, Jack and Sally. To hide the political motive for targeting Sally, he's become a serial killer, murdering women that look like her. Inspired by the city's Liberty Day holiday, he carves a Liberty Bell into his victims as misdirection. The press dubs him the Liberty Bell Strangler, a cheeky, literal way to suggest liberty being choked out in the United States. In one scene, Burke stalks a prostitute into a public restroom. What does De Palma associate with bathrooms just as Burke walks in the door? Hitchcock and Psycho, of course. Like many De Palma films, the DNA of Hitchcock and Herman is all over Blowout. As with the previous Burke cue, some material sounds like Psycho suspense material. This scene where the sleazeball Manny tries to force himself on Sally. We might hear a similar mood of terror in a cue like this from Psycho. But perhaps the Hitchcock film that really haunts Blowout is Vertigo. The Vertigo connection begins with the relationship between Sally and Jack. The most memorable theme in Blowout belongs to the pair. It's introduced on solo piano when they meet in the hospital. The melody, also frequently given to a delicate solo flute, is romantic but very sorrowful. There's an inherent tragedy to it, a yearning that will go unrequited. Subconsciously, we know they're doomed. It's hard to imagine a variation of this theme that finds contentment. The love theme from Vertigo is a very different sounding composition. Jack and Sally's theme doesn't have the dreamy, spellbinding quality that Scotty and Madeline's theme does. but it does evoke a similar mixture of romance and tragedy. In Vertigo, a film more about unhealthy obsession, the romance is taken to a fever pitch. Vertigo sees a character repeating the same mistake, as Scotty Ferguson must watch the woman he loves die the same way, twice. His desperation to resurrect his experience from before results in the same consequence. Harry Call in The Conversation is terrified of repeating his past mistake, allowing someone to get hurt or killed again because of a recording he's made. In doing so, he fulfills his own prophecy. He thinks he's protecting the victims, but he's protecting the killers, and someone else is killed because he holds on to the tapes. De Palma probably recognized the Vertigo connection when he borrowed from The Conversation a similar motivation and ironic fate for Jack Terry in Blowout. Jack was involved in a sting operation to expose police corruption. Like Harry Call, he was doing audio surveillance, putting a wire on someone undercover. But the man started sweating, causing the battery to arc. It burned the man's back, and he was found out. Jack discovered his body, literally strangled by Jack's microphone wire. It's this event, this guilty failure of justice, that turned Jack into a cynic. Early on, Jack is established working in his studio, lost in his process, and hardly watching the political news reports on TV. But after the death of the governor, and as the world around him denies him of what he can see and hear so clearly, the need for truth is reawakened. On Liberty Day, he arranges for Sally to wear a wire when she meets the press to hand over the film strip, but Burke is impersonating the reporter. Jack has delivered Burke's target right into his hands. The sequence starts building up a secondary part of Jack and Sally's theme, a sort of yearning or desperation motif. It's first introduced softly on flute when Jack asks Sally to stick around in town for a while to help him figure out the conspiracy. We'll hear it again as a subway car carrying Sally and Burke rushes away, and Jack dashes around to find a way to follow. The drama inherent in the motif asks us, can love, goodness, justice, can all these things prevail in the world? But like the rest of Jack and Sally's theme, it's laced with tragedy already. We sort of already know De Palma's answer. Jack can hear Burke attacking Sally, and eventually he makes out her location. In a last-ditch attempt, he runs toward her. De Palma expands the moment in slow motion. Fireworks explode in the sky. Jack pushes past the Liberty Day revelers and a patriotic marching band. Again, we hear the desperation part of Sally and Jack's theme. Will goodness, justice, love prevail? Jack is too late. Sally has been strangled to death, echoing the last time he tried to do what's right. This time, someone he knew and cared about deeply. Jack and Sally's theme haunts the remainder of the film, just as the love theme haunts Vertigo. Jack is seen sitting in the winter snow, listening to her last moments recorded from the wire, tormented by her screams. During this ending sequence, the theme reaches similar emotional heights to Vertigo. In a final irony, a broken-down Jack has placed her scream in the slasher film that began the movie.
Now that's a scream!
Jack,
more on the screen.
I don't want to start it.
Come on, bring it up.
All right, I'll give you a little bit more the next time. That's
her pain, her death, has been reduced to a sound effect in a B-grade splatter film. In a way, it's an inversion of the truth that was discovered when he married sound and image to reveal the gunshot. Now, a staged shot of a girl screaming in the shower is combined with the sound of a real scream. A true moment to create an artificial experience. With cinema, the truth has been re-obscured. In Vertigo, the love theme reaches its final resolute tragedy in big orchestral form. Scotty stands on the edge of a tower, looking down at the body of the woman he loves below, gone for a second time. Blowout ends with its own anguished rendition of Jack and Sally's theme. Jack plugs his ears as the director loops the scream over and over again. Thrilled about the sound. This final act of plugging one's ear is the ultimate tragedy. Beyond the implied guilt over causing someone's death, it sees a man that nearly broke out of his apathy, covering his ears to the truth because it's too hard to hear. And as the strings weep powerfully in the score, it's almost as if they're trying and failing to get through to Jack. Blowout sees the truth as doomed to be lost, to be obscured. Similarly, the conversation recognizes our failure to be able to grasp it. And Blow Up, the film that preceded all, suggests that grasping it is totally impossible. Without a doubt, these three films are in a fascinating dialogue with each other, and at the core of their interconnection is an endlessly complex study of society, reality, and perception. We must acknowledge, however, that as we look at them closely, the truth will be skewed. We're creating our own meaning from their grain. That does it for this episode of Keynotes. All of our episodes are written and produced by Nick Nylon. Before I go, I want to list off some sources that were essential to this episode. All books listed can be found on Amazon.com, and all podcasts on iTunes. My most valuable resource on this episode was Juan Chadha's Film Score Guide, a complex analysis of the conversation and its music, and research gathered from interviews with Shire himself. Film commentaries from Francis Ford Coppola and Walter Murch on the Conversation Blu-ray, the commentary for Blow Up by film critic Peter Burnett, which is only available on the DVD release. David Forjak's essay Blow Up in the Details, included in the Criterion Collection release of Blow Up. Stephen Benedict's podcasts on Blow Up, The Conversation, and Blowout. The Canon's podcast and commentary on Blowout. James Mangold's interview on Edith Bowman's podcast, Soundtracking, in which he discusses the musical influences of Logan. David Shire's interview with Film Score Monthly, where he discusses his work on Zodiac. If you liked this podcast, check out the Discarded Images video essay on The Conversation, entitled Who's Tracking Who, which can be found on YouTube. You might also check out Drew Morton's video essay on Vimeo, entitled Crosscut, which connects Blow Up, The Conversation, and Blowout entirely with visuals. I'd love to hear your thoughts on the podcast. Please subscribe, rate, review, or just leave a comment on iTunes or your respective podcast platform. You can email us at keynotespodcast@gmail.com. You can find Keynotes on Twitter at one word, at Keynotes Podcast. And you can find me on Twitter at Nick Nylund. I'm also co-host of another podcast, a more casual discussion-based show called Spinoff, which tackles new film releases and connects them to other movies. Please check it out, which you can find on Twitter at @spinoff_podcast. The link is in our bio. And finally, to play us out, here's The Theme from The Conversation by David Shire. Thanks for listening.